Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, debt ceiling crisis grips Washington, the Murdoch empire reels, and an assassination rocks Afghanistan. High tension talks in Washington, but no deal. On Monday, the president blamed the GOP.
I do not see a path to a deal if they don't budge, period. I mean, if the basic proposition is it's my way or the highway, then we're probably not going to get something done because we've got divided government.
GOP negotiators want big cuts but no new revenues, period. Here's House Majority Leader Eric Cantor.
If that's what he's looking for, we're not going there, because right now this economy is ailing, and we don't believe, nor do I think the American people believe, that raising taxes is the answer.
And press lord Rupert Murdoch and his News Corp in big trouble in the UK and maybe here. Here's the British Prime Minister David Cameron before Parliament.
What the public want us to do is address this firestorm. They want us to sort out bad practices at the media. They want us to fix the corruption in the police. They want a proper public inquiry. And they are entitled to ask, when these problems went on for so long, for so many years, what was it that happened in the last decade?
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Zanny Mitten-Meadows from The Economist, Christina Bellantoni from CQ Roll Call, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. Are we headed off a cliff with this debt ceiling stalemate? What is the way here? And is this country immune from the Murdoch ethics issues? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We're joined today by Zanny Mitten-Meadows, economics editor for The Economist magazine, just back from London. Zanny, great to have you.
Thanks. Great to be here.
With us from Washington, Christina Bellantoni of CQ Roll Call in the thick of the struggle on Capitol Hill. Christina, thanks very much for joining us.
That's right. Thanks for having me.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point news analyst Jack Beatty is here. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Zanny, and Christina.
Boy, this has been just some kind of week. Let's listen to just a few of the voices here. This is Lindsey Graham, South Carolina Republican senator, on a train on Wednesday talking with ABC News reporter Jonathan Carl. You'll hear Jonathan Carl first.
Bottom line, does the debt ceiling get raised by August 2nd?
I don't know. Right now, I'm very worried. If I were a betting man, I'd bet no.
He'd bet no, and nobody knows how to bet right now. House Speaker John Boehner and Majority Leader Eric Cantor told reporters Thursday they were in the fight together, that talk of a split in the GOP over all this is wrong.
We don't want to raise taxes, and that we want to structurally change the system so that we stop this from happening again. And Leader Reid is, I imagine, frustrated, as we all are. And the fact is, we are going to abide by our principles. And that's how it is, and I'm sure the Speaker joins me in that.
Let me just say, we have been in this fight together. And any suggestion that the role that Eric has played in this meeting has been anything less than helpful is just wrong. Listen, we're in the foxhole.
In the foxhole, says the Speaker John Boehner there on Thursday. Missouri Democratic Senator Claire McCaskill told MSNBC's Joe Scarborough she could not understand why, she said, the GOP isn't going for a big package of changes.
Why aren't the Republicans stepping up and saying we need to get rid of all these tax goodies and lower the corporate rate, lower the individual rate, and apply some of the money towards the deficit? That's the thing that could make the deal right now. Life of me, I can't figure out. I think Mitch McConnell, frankly, has lost his mind.
Ooh, lost his mind. And here's Alan Simpson, co-chair of the President's Debt Commission, Republican, former senator, telling ABC reporter Tuesday he was disappointed in his own party.
If that's the stuff that's going on in my party, where the pettiness overcomes the patriotism, it's disgusting to me.
Wow, that's a little sound from this week. Christina Bellantoni, take us to Capitol Hill and what's going on here. I'm reading David Rogers in Politico today, saying time is running short, and to describe Congress as a confused, even panicky army at this stage is not an overstatement. Is there a path to a solution that has any, visible chance right now, Christina? What's going on?
Well, there's nothing like a last-minute deadline to put pressure on lawmakers to actually get something done. You're going to continue to see this wrangling for another week or so, I think. You know, the president is doing its press conference, and I think that you're going to have Republican leaders responding to it and playing this out on the airwaves instead of actually sitting down in that room and negotiating details. Roll Call had a story last night talking about, it's interesting, the discussions about Boehner and Cantor, because Eric Cantor apparently did not say a peep last night in the White House meeting, which lasted for about 80 minutes.
This is after the day before where he later came out and said the president stormed out on him. The Democrats say, no, he just wrapped it up and walked. But it was a high tension the day before.
Exactly. So there's a lot of frayed nerves about this. And meanwhile, all of the lawmakers that aren't sitting in that room, everybody but those eight people, are just twiddling their thumbs. Monday, you're going to be back where it's the recess has been canceled. What are House lawmakers going to do? Well, they're going to demagogue on the issue. So there's just going to be a lot more pressure building and building on this. And meanwhile, Obama's going to use that bully pulpit to warn of a crisis and to say the Republicans aren't compromising. The White House has been really pushing this idea that we've laid a lot on the table and we're really willing to sacrifice and we've come a long way and the Republicans need to come along with us.
Jack, it would seem that the time for demagoguing on whatever side or taking to the airwaves should be behind us here. It seems like time to buckle down, but nobody wanted to go to Camp David with the president this weekend.
No, and to me, the comment of the day is from the Financial Times. They say observers have begun comparing U.S. political dysfunction with that of Italy. Now comes the sentence, judging by recent days, the comparison is unfair to Italy. It really is extraordinary. And when you look at the deal on offer, I mean, for a little give in taxes, Republicans could have won. They could yet win a major victory. The president was willing to accept a higher ratio of spending cuts to tax increases than the average Republican voter. He was slightly to the right of the average Republican voter, according to calculations by Nate Silver of the Times. But that is not good enough for Eric Cantor and the 97% of House Republicans who signed Grover Norquist's pledge, no new taxes from here to eternity. Their position is spending cuts alone are all they will accept to cut the deficit. And that is a position shared by only 26% of Republicans.
Zanny Mitten-Beddoes, you've been watching this in recent days from London, now from New York. What do you see unfolding in Washington?
Well, I share everybody else's views. I mean, it's quite extraordinary. I've been watching this, and for a long time I've thought it's somewhat like a pantomime, right? You have people acting in exaggerated form, and I've always assumed that at the end they would stop roaring, stop shouting, and we would have a deal, and we'd come back to the kind of real world, everyone had played their roles, and we'd come back to good sense. But the closer we get to this, the more I wonder that this pantomime is turning into somewhat of a horror show, and people are kind of so stuck in their roles that we really do have a very serious accident. And when you look at this from the other side of the Atlantic, I was, as you said, just in London, mm-hmm. You know, you look in Europe where there is a very real debt crisis. There is very real specter of default in countries like Greece for very good economic reasons. Here, it's an entirely fabricated default. It's an entirely unnecessary, self-made situation. And so for people on the other side of the Atlantic, they're just scratching their heads and kind of thinking, what is going on in the U.S.? You know, have these people lost their minds?
Christine, I mean, this is the moment, though, when the Tea Partiers who came in on that 2010 election, they were put in there. They said, we're going to fight the deficit. We're going to go hammer and tongs after it. We're going to take government down. They see their leverage here, and they clearly do not want to let it go, even if maybe John Boehner's willing to some degree.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things you're seeing come out of this group of eight in the White House, everybody's saying, we all agree default is not an option. That's nine people in the room that agree that. When you talk about all these people that are sitting on Capitol Hill and going back home to their constituents and saying, now is our opportunity to really take a stand on government spending, John Boehner has a real problem. He's going to lose up to 70 of his Republicans on this vote, regardless of what happens, which is why compromise is so important with
the Democrats. Now, what do you mean there? What 70? What's the complexion of that 70, and what vote are you referring to?
It's not just Tea Party activists. Mm-hmm. It's these conservative Republicans that fear primaries. And then it is people that won in primaries in 2010. And then it is this new freshman class of Tea Partiers. You know, sort of that three group compounding are these 70 people that could very well vote against increasing the debt ceiling. They say regardless of what kind of cuts in spending or caps might be attached to it. That's why you're seeing a lot of emphasis on this balanced budget amendment that is going to get a vote next week. That's one way for them to be able to put their stamp saying, well, we called for that, so it's okay that we voted to increase the debt ceiling.
But you're saying he won't have 70 Republicans on this vote, but what's the vote you're expecting at this point now? Do you think that Mitch McConnell's compromise that would have President Obama kind of on his own over Republican objections, you know, raising the ceiling and raising it again and raising it again over the next year, is that going to come to a vote in the House?
I do not think so. I think that instead you will see a vote on whatever compromise plan they negotiate at the very last minute. You'll have an 11th hour, middle of the night vote, and then they'll go home. That's sort of how it always ends up working in Washington. I think that it'll be everybody gives just a little bit. The Republicans are going to have to give a little bit more because exactly what I was just saying about Boehner losing mm-hmm. those 70 Republicans means he needs Democratic votes. So
but Jack, if I may, sorry, Christina, but Jack, the break is coming here, but this has not seemed like a give just a little bit drama unfolding here. It's been, you know, digging in big time.
Yes, and I think Christina puts her finger on the dynamic. For, you know, people say it's ideology on the part of the Tea Party. That's probably true, but ideology is not an independent variable. It's dependent on elections and fear. And Republicans are afraid of being primary. There's just no question about it.
Grover Norquist, that is challenged from the right if they don't stay hard on this.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And Grover Norquist has put them on notice. I don't know about the Koch brothers. I don't. But their money is out there. And so, you know, it's very hard to say to a politician, risk losing your office to vote for a president you don't like for a policy, you know, raising the debt ceiling you abhor.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we are looking at a big week in the news. Debt ceiling crisis right around us now. Tax talks, but no breakthrough. Murdoch reeling, and the News Corp in the UK over all the allegations there, and more than that, an assassination in Afghanistan. The president of Afghanistan climbing down into the grave of his half-brother, Ahmed Wali Karzai, there near Kandahar, the family home. Zanny Minton-Beddoes is with us from The Economist this hour. Christina Bellantoni of CQ Roll Call. Jack Beatty's here. Ben Bernanke, Federal Reserve Chair, making no bones this week about the economic potential consequences of allowing the country to default.
In terms of jobs, you know, if I think the worst outcome if we don't raise the debt limit is that at some point, you know, we default on the debt, and that would create as I said before, a huge financial calamity, which in turn would affect everybody and would set job creation back very significantly.
Huge financial calamity. The Fed chief does not usually use language like that. Tony in Manchester, Connecticut, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thank you.
Yes.
One of your guests just happened to mention Grover Norquist.
This is the no tax, never guy. Yep.
Right, and by coincidence, my local newspaper, the Journal Enquirer, had an op-ed piece in which his words were featured, and he is alleged to have said something along the lines that even if a Democrat does get the presidency, we will not allow him to act like a Democrat. And that struck me as the root of our problem. But I would go further and say that between Nordquist and the Koch brothers, no matter who is in, they are going to prohibit them from doing anything other than neoconservative ruling.
But Tony, are you looking right past the Republican majority in the House? I mean, that was an election too, and very recent, just last fall, and they won that majority.
Well, okay, but before we get too far into that, my basic bedrock premise is nothing in this country is going to change if we keep electing either Democrats or Republicans.
Okay, we got it, Tony. Those are the big options right now, though, and that's what's in Congress. But thank you for your call. Steve in Burlington, Vermont. Steve, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to say a couple of things. First off, I think the Republicans are playing a game with the country. When they say no new taxes, they're not saying no new taxes on everybody. Don't even believe that. They're saying no new taxes on the rich. Let's get that right, number one. They don't say rich because they want to get reelected or elected. Number two, Obama should have done what Bush did and just passed in his first year when he had full control of the House and the Senate. He should have passed everything he wanted to pass right through and not play Mr. Nice Guy and try to be bipartisan and all that. He should have just put it through. That's number two. And number three, the Republicans, again, about playing games, they started with the word liberal, and that was, oh, my God, don't vote for him. He's a liberal. That's bad. And then that stopped working after a while. People got sick of that, so then they started saying socialist. Ooh, that's bad, too.
Steve, I appreciate your call. Thanks for calling. Let's hear from Obama himself. This is on CBS News on Thursday, talking with Chris May about his reportedly strained relationship with Republican Majority Leader Eric Cantor.
I am willing to work with everybody, including Eric Cantor, to solve problems. And, you know, my relationship with all the leaders has been cordial. It has been professional. But I think at a certain point, the American people run out of patience if they think that people are playing games and not serious in terms of solving problems.
Jack, there's the president again standing as the adult in the room or positioning himself that way. Is that working, Jack?
It seems to be working with public opinion if you judge what people think about who will be to blame if there were a shutdown by, I don't know, 10 or 12 points. People say the Republicans would be to blame. So they would bear the onus. And the president and even and in a subsequent poll and like a Quinnipiac poll, the president is actually rated higher for managing the economy than the Republicans, even though the president's overall ratings on the economy are pretty dismal. So he seems to have the edge, but it's the edge of a cliff because, of course, if there is a default or even a hiccup, that slows economic growth, that just adds yet another increment of bad news for next year when the president will bear the sole responsibility for the state of the economy.
And Bernanke doesn't say hiccup. He says calamity.
Calamity.
Jack, you were pointing out a poll to me on the president and registered voters and who and what they say they're ready to vote for right now.
That's right. He is the generic poll shows that the president is 47% to 39 voters favor a generic Republican over President Obama. This is the Gallup poll right now. Of course, a generic Republican is not Mitt Romney. It's not, Michelle Bachmann. Nevertheless, this is a pretty alarming finding, it seems to me, for the president.
It hardly sounds like, you know, the standing of the only adult in the room. Christina Bellantoni, what about the politics of this? I mean, how do people figure it now? Or is it just raw fear, this kind of confusion and panic that David Rogers is describing in Congress?
There is a lot of panic. I think that you're looking at the potential for multiple votes that these members are going to be held accountable for, Democrats, conservative Republicans, candidates for Senate, President Obama, and all of these candidates that want to challenge President Obama next year. None of them are going to have to vote on this. Michelle Bachmann, we've already heard she's going to have to vote no. None of them are going to have to take a yes vote on this, I should say. You know, I can guarantee you Ron Paul is not going to vote for it, and the rest of them aren't serving in Congress. So this is going to be a real mess electorally. And don't forget, if the stock market tumbles as they still struggle to get to some sort of deal and you keep hearing these chaotic, you know, behind-the-scenes meetings, I think that that's going to cause real problems. In September 2008, the stock market went down 777 points, and that had a dramatic effect on that incoming presidential election. And I think that you're going to see a lot of that happen right about next week.
Let's go to John in New Haven, Connecticut. That's a scary thought. But John in New Haven, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I just would like somebody to explain this to me like I was a 15-year-old high school kid. But I don't see how we've been deficit spending since the Johnson administration. We've been spending more money than we take in. We've accumulated $14-plus trillion in debt.
Yep.
And now the Republicans, the Tea Party, is saying, no, we're going to cut spending and we're not going to raise taxes. In fact, we're going to cut taxes. So, and we're going to grow the economy to pay off the debt. The economy, I heard the other day, is probably only going to grow at 2%. I don't see where, if we cut spending just to balance budget, we'd lay off 40% of the government. I don't see how that's going to fix anything, because that's going to put millions of people out of work.
So what are you saying, like the Democrats, you've got to have revenues, taxes in here also, John?
We've got to have revenue to keep the government running. And if we let the country go into default, everybody's 401k holds probably some government securities, and if interest rates double or triple on our government securities, it's going to mean that they go to half or a third of their value. And when everybody's 401k looks like a 104k.
Yeah, not to mention what that does to the cost of interest on that government debt. Zanny Minton Beddoes, what about this issue? It's the core issue here now. It's the big stumbling block. The president says, I'll do a big deal. In fact, he and John Boehner seem to have had an agreement, a $4 trillion deficit reduction deal, as long as there are some revenues in there, that as long as we're trying to bring this down. The sort of Cantor wing saying no way to that. How does that look? Give us a sort of, I don't know, European, global, transatlantic, New York perspectives, Annie. Does it look ideological or reasonable for the Republicans to say no to new revenues when the deficit's this big?
Well, I don't know about the global perspective, but let me give you my perspective, which is, I think the caller is absolutely right. That there are two perspectives on this. The very short term, the U.S. is not about to be insolvent at this very moment. The U.S. is raising money very cheaply. The U.S., yes, it has a high debt-to-GDP ratio, but it's not out of control. What is problematic is that if you look into the medium term, the U.S. public finances are on an unsustainable path. You know, 5, 10 years' time, it's totally unsustainable. So the U.S. desperately needs a kind of path to sustainable public finances. And it seems to me that that path has to involve two elements. It has to involve reform of entitlements, but it also has to involve more revenue. The U.S. tax revenues as a share of the economy are incredibly low, and there is just no way in the medium term to sort out this country's public finances, I don't think, without more tax revenue. Now, the good thing is that the U.S. tax system is unbelievably inefficient, and so it raises relatively little money very, very inefficiently. So if you had a tax reform that got rid of a lot of the tax deductions, flattened rates, had perhaps a VAT, which I know is an anathema to many people.
Value-added tax, yep.
Value-added tax. There are many ways in which you could do it. But over the medium term, I find it very hard to see how the U.S. public finances are sorted out with no tax revenue of any sort. And so I think that in the end, the Republican absolutism is completely untenable.
Well, Christina, can we now see the outlines of some kind of bargain there? I mean, you know, Mitch McConnell's saying, here's a way, but it's kind of a big gimmick, and everybody knows it. Politico this morning saying it's like telling Pickett's Charge to go around Cemetery Ridge and not up it if you're a Tea Partier. But do you see the outlines of something that might work here, Christina?
No, I don't think the president does not want to make his Democratic members take three more votes on this before the election. And certainly he doesn't want to have to sign three more votes.
That's the McConnell path.
Yeah.
But that's seen as the most likely compromise, if there could be a way to thread the needle here, isn't it?
No, I don't think so. And I don't think the people in the room look at it as that. I mean, they're fiddling with the numbers here. I mean, you keep hearing this, you know, 1.4 trillion to 1.7 trillion. And they're trying to edge it up to 2 trillion. And I think that you're going to keep seeing that tinkering around the edges with that number, and eventually you're going to have some sort of compromise the Democrats are able to sign off on. Whether that ends up being with entitlements or not is, I think, the biggest and most important question. By the way, don't forget, in all of this, the American people and these voters say that they want jobs. They want a focus on unemployment. So none of this actually will improve the economy in any way. Now, granted, if it falls apart, it could really hurt the economy.
Alan Simpson says he doesn't think it's going to happen. A deal's not going to be made at this point. You heard Lindsey Graham say he's worried that it won't be. S&P, Standard & Poor's, the rating agency, saying 50-50 that the U.S. goes into default here and gets downgraded. How are you calling it? Now, the president is telling people the deadline is next Friday, but he doesn't seem to have much authority to really set a deadline here.
I hear what Mitch McConnell said to Laura Ingraham, saying, we do not want to be responsible for a default that then hurts the Republican Party. We want the president to own this economy. So that's where I think they're going to have to raise this. And the Democrats are, you talked about being the grown-up in the room, the Democrats are going to have to step up to that, even though, traditionally, the party that's not in power has always had the luxury of voting no on this. They do not have that luxury next week when they get to this.
Jack Beatty, last word on the crisis we're in the midst of right here.
Oh, well, it's the times that try men and women's souls, that's for sure. And I think we're seeing what our political men and women are made of. I mean, it hasn't been a good week for Eric Cantor in particular, who, you know, you've got to be sympathetic to his dilemma. He represents his constituency in the House. But the blind quotes from Republican senators, mostly in Politico, about him have been pretty devastating. And he hasn't his political future. I think people talked about vice presidential nominee and so on. All of that may be at risk. That's of course the least of it in here. But it is interesting to watch the behavior of these people under pressure. Yeah,
so you say, Jack. But if Michelle Bachmann's the candidate, he might fit right in there. We're going to talk more about Michelle Bachmann on Monday. Let's take a turn. Maybe Charles will help us do it here. There's been a lot going on in Zanny Minton Beddoes in London, where you've just been. Charles calling from Boston. You're on the air, Charles.
Oh, hello, Tom. How are you? I'm a big fan of your show.
Thanks.
And I was just wondering, really, when it comes to this particular issue on the debt crisis.
Yes.
Really, how are people looking at it in terms of its fundamental, argument being here? Is it simply a matter of, as someone said earlier, is it simply a matter of budgeting and taxes and how much money is on this side and then that side, or is it really an issue of the role of government and what are the Tea Parties trying to do? Are they trying to really just change society as we know it overnight on August 5th or 6th, and all of a sudden we're looking at a different world?
Well, maybe not overnight, but definitely committed to a change here. And they've been led in no small part there, on the media front by Fox News kind of rallying around a change, a different perspective on what's wanted in Washington. Charles, I thought you were looking at Murdoch and what we see across the pond in the UK and his presence here. What do you say? Oh, sorry, we lost Charles there. Well, Charles isn't going to speak to it. Let's let Hugh Grant speak to it. One of the many victims of the Murdoch phone hacking scandal in the UK. Reporters just blasting right in there on all kinds of people there. Huge uproar in Britain about it. On Wednesday, Grant told NBC's Today Show that British government officials may have ignored the case for political reasons.
He had the power through his papers to get them elected. And his paper knew, you know, dirty details about individual MPs, and so they were unwilling ever to take him on.
And there we have Zanny Minton Beddoes. I mean, this seems to be, it's such a big scandal in the UK now, but at the heart of it seems to be that he had Britain's political class kind of, or at least News Corp, or at least the papers that were doing this, wrapped around their finger, afraid to speak out against it, even when all kinds of ethical boundaries were being crossed here, because they might then, you know, be looked in on by phone hacking reporters and be embarrassed, and worse, in the public eye, Zanny.
Absolutely. I mean, it is a scandal that has engulfed Britain. It's even higher on the news than the U.S. Debt ceiling pantomime. It's one, you know, it's a convolution of all kinds of things. There's the drama of the cracks in the Murdoch empire and the public revulsion about what they actually did. But as you say, the relationship between the tabloid press and the UK political class, and indeed the police, the role of the police is, this is very important. Mm-hmm. I mean, the police who are accepting, it appears, accepting bribes to do this. All of that has kind of all the ingredients for the most unbelievable drama, and it's convulsed Britain. I think the questions that come out of it in the UK, there's a lot of soul-searching going on about not just the power that Murdoch wielded, but the coziness of the relationship between politicians and journalists. There's a little bit, I think, of sort of overreaction in the sense that I think people must have known that some things were going on for a long time. So it's reminded me a little bit of that scene, you know, in Casablanca, mm-hmm. the movie.
Shocked
that there's gambling going on. Yeah. But yeah. It really feels like a turning point in the UK in terms of relationships between the press and the political elite.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, a brutal heat wave in the South and Midwest now headed east. In Washington, road crew supervisor Larry Blackston was watching his crew in the heat.
Got plenty of drink, got a wet, cold rag. You got to do something down here because this concrete be up to 120 probably today.
In Palm Desert, California, funeral services this week for bright and brave former First Lady Betty Ford. Friend and former First Lady Rosalynn Carter spoke.
She was never afraid to speak the truth, even about the most sensitive subjects, including her own struggles with alcohol and painkillers.
And high excitement at the Women's World Cup in Germany. A gritty U.S. team headed to the championship game against Japan on Saturday. Here was their big victory, big break against powerhouse Brazil. We're looking at a big week in the news. Debt ceiling crisis, Murdoch reeling, and assassination in Afghanistan. Zanny Mitten-Beddoes is with us from The Economist, Christina Bellantoni from CQ Roll Call, and Jack Beattie. Let's go to John in Amherst, Massachusetts. John, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I would like to put forth the proposition that Murdoch's debacle in England and our budget crisis here are not totally unrelated, in that Murdoch's influence on U.S. politics via Fox, the Wall Street Journal, et cetera, has had the effect of extreme polarization and whipping up a fury on the Tea Party right of the Republican Party that is now almost uncontrollable. And I was wondering if perhaps a similar investigation into Murdoch's meddling and malfeasance here in the U.S. might help prevent political impasses in the future here.
Well, I mean, we should say what's on the table right now is the Congressman Peter King has said he's concerned that there may have been the same kind of phone hacking of families, victims of 9/11 in this country, and wants to look at that. But it may go wider. Here's Senator Jay Rockefeller on Wednesday telling a CNN reporter that there would be a Senate investigation into the Murdoch scandal.
You know that the Department of Justice and all kinds of other federal agencies are going to be going after this very hard, and we will too.
Zanny, give us some perspective here. I mean, what he's really in the dock for in the UK is this very material breach of ethics in going after families, victims of, you know, in murder cases, war victims, terror attack victims there, but also against politicians. But it's more about phone hacking. I mean, Murdoch's been on both the conservative and liberal, if you will, side in the UK. What about our callers, sort of reaching further to a sort of a more conceptual complaint about Murdoch in this country and his impact on our political discourse?
Well, it's an interesting comparison. I think one of the reasons that people are so exercised about what the Murdoch empire has done is because it's so politically polarizing. But I think it is worth making the distinction that the allegations or the concerns in England are about breaking the law, that, you know, members of journalists in the Murdoch newspapers broke the law, and that there was that, and then the relationship with the police. There are very specific and very serious potential allegations there. The broader concern, I think, of one of the reasons it's become such a sort of big, huge political issue is not just revulsion at those kind of tactics, but a huge suspicion about the power and influence of the Murdoch empire in the UK. And I can see the same a parallel thought process going on here. And I think you're absolutely right that the most interesting next question for the commercial future of News Corp is what happens in the U.S. You know, whether these initial FBI investigations, etc., lead anywhere. I mean, one question is whether under the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act there is any concern about the actions that were done by a U.S. company in London. So I think there's a potentially a lot more that can happen on this side of the Atlantic, and that's, I think, very, very important for the commercial future of News Corp. I
mean, it seems Les Hinton, who was the head of News International. This is from 95 to 2007. That's the time when these examples of voicemail hacking by News Corp employees took place. He was the guy in charge, and he is now, you know, chief executive of Dow Jones, publisher of the Wall Street Journal, the tip-top of Murdoch's American news media empire, 50-year employee and counting Rupert Murdoch, about as close to him as you can be, and now he's right at the top jack of a very big publication, a very important one in this country.
Wall Street Journal, and here's his photograph in the Wall Street Journal today. Yes, I mean, it is a very awkward circumstance for Mr. Murdoch. You know, when Democrats on Senator Lautenberg, for example, raised the question of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act and should we, you know, calling for an investigation of Murdoch, frankly, that looked to me like using the power of the Senate or rattling, you know, subpoenas, or at least the threat of them, on political grounds. It just doesn't look good when a Democrat does that against Fox News. And we can't have that. We can't have, you know, the political branches slanging him because of his positions. That's why Peter King, I think, really has complicated the whole story. He is a Republican, a redoubtable Republican. And he's calling for these investigations.
And the FBI, don't forget.
Yes, indeed.
But yes, I think that you will hear, I mean, you know, Rockefeller is very key in this. The Democrats do still control the Senate. You are going to hear hearings about this. If they have an opportunity to fundraise off of it, they will. They know that anti-Fox News helps the Democratic Party, and they are going to definitely exercise that as often as possible.
Let's go to Danielle in Woodward, Iowa. Thanks for calling, Danielle. You're on the air.
Yes. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. And I guess I'll direct this to Jack, another populist. I'm a prairie populist.
Okay.
How can I not, as a citizen, and Jack made some very good points, don't go too far with this, but on BBC last evening I heard a little snippet about how Murdoch's organization had the British government cowed, and that is a term used by the BBC.
Cowed.
How can I not make the connection that there is a strong possibility that this has happened in this country?
Well, but what, I'll put it to Jack, Danielle, but what about the fact that, you know, he's gone both ways in the UK? I mean, he's been for Labour and he's been for Tories. He hasn't been consistently right or left there. They have lost him. Jack, what do you say to Danielle's question?
Well, you know, when you ask who's the nearest American equivalent as a power broker to what Rupert Murdoch was until yesterday in the UK, you know, who pulls politicians in his hand? Who threatens to break senators who don't follow his lead? Who is it, you know, remarkably, who manages to wield this power without a newspaper, without a cable network, without a poor personal fortune? It's Grover Norquist. I mean, let's face it, all but 7 Senate and 6 House Republicans have signed his pledge. Joe Klein of Time says that Norquist, of all people, has probably done more to precipitate the debt ceiling impasse than any single person in Washington, and his thumbprints would be on a U.S. default. Murdoch never dreamed of such power.
Let's go to Pat in New York, Petersburg, New York. Pat, thanks for calling. You're on.
Yeah, I was just wondering if it was so easy to get their phones hacked. It was common knowledge in England that their phones were being hacked because they were always in the newspapers. I'm talking about the politicians. I'm not talking about the people, you know, the accident people or whatever. Why didn't they just change their password? Or their code, rather. They seemed like they all had the same code. It was so easy to do. Did they want their phones hacked and they know what was going on in their lives just to get press?
Let us pick it up, Pat. Zanny, how about it? I mean, this week we had former Prime Minister of the UK, Gordon Brown. He accused Murdoch's newspapers of employing criminals to get confidential information to people when their lives were just at rock bottom. Furious. He said that, you know, raising questions about how the Sun newspaper obtained confidential information that his infant son, Fraser, had cystic fibrosis. He describes himself and his wife in tears after being informed by Rebecca Brooks so much in the news now that fact was going to be in all the papers in the UK. Our caller wants to know if politicians were happy to play along when it got them good press, Zanny.
Well, I think the caller said that it was widely known, everyone knew that their own phone voice messages were being hacked. I don't think that's true, and I think certainly ordinary people had no idea that this was going on and going on against ordinary people. With Gordon Brown, the story is somewhat complicated. I think in the past couple of days, it's not clear how the Sun got those, it got the information, and the Sun has been very, very clear about that it did not get it in a particular way. So I think the facts aren't actually completely clear then. But what is clear is that in certain cases, and we don't know quite how many and how widespread this was, the law has been broken, with people hacking into mobile phones. Why didn't everybody change their password? I don't think it was widely known by the population at large, or indeed by the celebrities where this began, that this was going on. So this, remember, this all happened a long time ago. It's now all finally coming to light, and the allegations about how broadly it went and quite how extreme it was are coming out. But it's all stuff that happened several years ago.
It's going to be really interesting with all the stakes here to see how this charge of kind of ethical infection maybe in this country plays out. I want to turn to Afghanistan, if we may. The amazing scene this week. First of all, after the assassination, point-blank range, by one of his closest allies of Ahmad Wali Karzai. This is the half-brother of the president of Afghanistan, Hamid Karzai. Strong man in Kandahar, fingers in all kinds of power pots there, and widely said in drugs as well. At the funeral, huge sea of mourners there, and the president of Afghanistan pushes through with his bodyguards, climbs down into his slain half-brother's freshly dug grave on Wednesday, sobbing alongside the coffin there. CBS News reports that it was down there for at least a minute, wailing, almost out of view down in the grave. Relatives could not coax him out. Two men finally locked their arms underneath Karzai and pulled him out by force. Jack, can only imagine what was going through the mind of the president of this country at that moment, down in that grave, after so much history in this last decade and a lifetime with his half-brother.
An extraordinary scene, and one punctuated by a bomb the next day, yesterday, in a mosque sort of holding a service for Ahmad Wali Karzai. It killed several people. You know, it's a sign of the moral pandemonium, really, of our policy in Afghanistan, that the assassination of this corrupt Kandahar strongman by a police official the Washington Post describes as a U.S. ally should make Afghanistan more dangerous and unpredictable. That's according to Afghan watchers. In life, Wali Karzai, the half-brother to the Afghan president, he was a land-grabbing, possibly drug-dealing provincial satrap, bribed by the CIA, but scorned by the U.S. military, which feared that his boodling would undermine the vestigial legitimacy of his brother's corrupt government. In death, well, he emerges as a U.S. asset, helped the CIA, kept the lid on in the South. Another Karzai brother, we read, Mahmoud, is expected to replace the departed. He is under criminal investigation for the U.S. Now, this is the scorecard. Corrupt brother number three replaces corrupt brother number two as our man in Kandahar at the behest of corrupt brother number one, our man in Kabul.
Let us remember, he always denied the corruption. Here he was. This is Ahmad Wali Karzai talking to the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation just last March.
There is no never proof. I might help people to facilitate things for them when it comes to security, when it comes to organizing meeting with the population, because I'm the only person who has all the facilities. We didn't start just with Hamid Karzai becoming the president. We were well known before that, my father, my grandfather, and grand-grandfather.
Long-time Karzai Power Center, Kandahar and that neighborhood, and actually Zanny touching, recounting this week of how after 9/11, when the war took off in November, here Ahmad Wali got his brother on a motorbike. This is now the president to head back into Afghanistan. Got a binoculars around his neck and some cash in his pocket, sent him back in. Of course, he's ultimately president. But the quagmire face here, looking difficult again, Zanny, as this power broker goes away.
I think that's absolutely right, and I think Jack put it very well. It's it's just a very telling sign, and sort of it brings it home in a very profound and I think quite alarming way of just how complicated things there are. And, you know, he was on the one hand someone, you know, definitely suspected of corruption, certainly a very complicated figure, to put it perhaps politely. And at the same time, he was integral and incredibly important to what the NATO strategy there is. And so I think it epitomizes just quite how difficult this situation is.
Lots of other events this week. Let us not miss Syria, where the French and U.S. embassies were both practically overrun by supporters of the regime there that's been under so much pressure. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, after that, roundly condemning the incident, issued a warning to Syria's President Bashar al-Assad.
If anyone, including President Assad, thinks that the United States is secretly hoping the regime will emerge from this turmoil to continue its brutality and repression, they are wrong. President Assad is not indispensable, and we have absolutely nothing invested in him remaining in power.
You know, but that sounds a little more menacing when you don't have the country in sort of fiscal chaos at home and everybody completely wrapped around that axle. Christina, other news this week, Roger Clemens, a mistrial in the case of him allegedly having committed perjury before Congress, talking about steroid and drug use as a great, great pitcher in baseball. That may never come to trial now. Anybody talking about that on Capitol Hill, the pitcher and his walk?
Well, last night was the roll call congressional baseball game, so there was some chatter about it in lines to buy pretzels. But really, you're not hearing much response to that because people are so focused on obviously the economy. But I think that you're going to hear a little bit more about this. You know, obviously, you know, drugs and baseball has been a topic that Congress has devoted an actual large amount of attention to. So it wouldn't shock me if you hear something next week come up on this.
Jack, it seems like kind of distant, I don't know, dippy days when Congress would spend time thinking about, you know, what was going on in the pitcher's mound, for heaven's sakes, here.
All the lighter things.
Yes, and just what portion of his anatomy was he getting this shot in? And, you know, on and on. I mean, yes, you know, it's hard not to feel some sympathy for Roger as a Red Sox fan. He gave us so much pleasure. On the other hand, you don't want to lie to Congress.
No, but, hey, bloody gauze up against everything we're looking at here. Maybe a walk is in order. All eyes on Washington next weekend and through this weekend as this thing continues to unfold. Christina Bellantoni with CQ Roll Call in Washington. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Zanny Mitten-Meadows with The Economist. Thanks, Zanny.
Thank you.
And thank you, Jack. Listeners, have a great weekend. This is On Point.